our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Red Sox pitchers and catchers reporting tomorrow. Spring must be almost here, and of course, ready for, 6-7 months away from a duck boat parade when the Red Sox stun the world.
You are the second guy in the last 10 minutes who has made a Red Sox comment to me. I was at the Golden Goose, the local market down the street, had my 2018 damage done sweatshirt on, and he said to me, so how you think the Sox are going to do this year? I said, they're going to be terrible. It's not going to go well at all. But at least they'll be moving on, I believe. I hope I'm wrong. And it goes splendidly, but at least they'll be moving on from Heim Bloom, get a guy who really should be running the baseball team in place and understands the market.
What strange injury do you think will hit Chris Sale this year?
That's presuming it hasn't already hit him, and you just haven't been told about it yet.
Right.
And then maybe it happened like 3 months ago, and he'll wait another 4 months before he'll have some surgery. It's just not good for me to talk about him because, as you may know, there is no one I respect less in the history as a player of the Boston Red Sox franchise than Chris Sale. It's fake as just fake tough guy and as overrated as you get. I cannot stand anything that he stands for.
And you pegged him years ago. I'll give credit where credit is due. You saw that before a lot of Red Sox fans did.
Oh, the worst was, speaking of my sweatshirt, when they won that championship in 2018, despite him, largely, also despite Mookie Betts, but Mookie Betts contributed in other ways throughout the season and in other seasons. When Chris Sale wanted to have it used to be the front cover of Sports Illustrated moment, that final out, he gave you nothing. And then he just comes in so he can get the tough guy, close it out when they're up by like 4 runs or whatever it was. So you just needed to have an ERA less than 30. And you would have been having that amazing cover shot, that money shot moment. I just thought, remember how Junior Seau, when he was racking up those tackles, the play would be over. The ball carrier would be on the ground. There'd be a pile. And Seau would come in and be like, oh, I'm getting on top of this pile. Can I have half a tackle? So many of his tackle stats came from that. And I remember thinking, who are you? Junior Seau? Chris Sale? Oh, he just disgusts me.
All right, we're going to move on to musical things because I don't want to be the cause of driving up your blood pressure here.
I feel like I'm good. I have some stairs in the bank.
Yeah, you're all set.
So, yeah, I can take it.
All right. Well, let's talk a little music, though. A new release of Jimi Hendrix live at the Los Angeles Forum in April 1969. And what a powerhouse recording.
I know what happened around your place. I stripped down late at night, took some shrooms, cranked this up. Boy knocked on the door and said, Dad, what's going on in there? And you said, not now, son. I'm having a spiritual moment. But it is a very spiritual, I feel like, sound that Hendrix had in the spring of 1969. He is with the original guys that he had made his big entrance in 1966 with. And he wasn't always with them like towards the end of his career, what we think of as the end of his very brief career. And there was this Hendrix bootleg that came out forever ago. And it was also from 1969. It was a show in Denmark. And it was called Electric Church Music. I've always liked that title. It seems like that's what you're hearing with this particular archival release that had come out last year, is that notion of electric church music. Hendrix has always struck me, for all of the volume, as chamber music. Like back in the day, if you were a lord, you'd be like, I would like to hear some really fine things on the violin, and you'd sit in your bedchamber. And someone would come in and regale you with their amazing technical prowess on the instrument. And it was a very cultured, cultivated way to experience music. I think of Hendrix as someone who comes to the boudoir, so to speak, and is playing that electric church music. Electric church music makes it sound like it's holy, but it's outside, so it's secular. And it has that idea, too, of that the virtuosity of chamber music. You can't be ham-fisted and play chamber music. It wouldn't work. You couldn't have, like, a classical version of the Replacements, for instance, playing chamber music. So that's how I've always looked at his music. It's very serious, something to listen to with great intention, great purpose.
an amazing version of Voodoo Child, and I was surprised and then just blown away by his cover of Sunshine of Your Love.
Sunshine of Your Love was a song that he did quite a few times, and it was originally done there's a famous version or an infamous version from the Lulu program, and he and the trio, they weren't supposed to do that song. They were playing something else, and Hendrix essentially said, screw this, we're going to pay our respects to the Cream, a group that we really love. Cream was breaking up at the time, or just broken up. And the lick, the riff, is tailor-made for someone like Hendrix. And we have to keep in mind, too, that all of these players who went to see Hendrix, whether it was Pete Townsend or Eric Clapton, the Beatles, it really isn't as relevant because no one in the Beatles was considered like a top guitar player in the world. But for the other top guitar players, for the actual top guitar players in the world, to hear this guy, it just changed everything about the game. It was the same sport, but now there were all these new rules, or maybe no rules, but it went from being a running back league to throwing it down the field 40 yards on every pass type of league. So for him to turn around and have this homage and this lasting fondness for this Cream song, I think is telling. Because there's been, when Cream came out, they were just considered so exciting. No one had done what they had done. In their power trio way, it's smaller, but they were as exciting to hardcore listeners at the time as the Beatles had been 2 or 3 years before. So Hendrix got that. These people who play music well, whether it's Dylan, whether it's Hendrix, whether it was some John Coltrane, the music that they had covered, the standards, they're phenomenal at listening. They're just masters of having this formidable record collection that they tote around mentally with them. So that's what we get here with Hendrix in that particular cover.
He's, of course, always in the conversation for greatest rock guitarists of all time, but do you think he's maybe underrated as a vocalist?
Oh, I do. Yeah, definitely. I would say that he had, he's one of those guys, like, he doesn't sound like him, but I think Keith Ralph is underrated as a vocalist, where they're those blues singers who really go for it. But Hendrix, if he couldn't play guitar as well as he does, and it was 1934, and you gave him an acoustic guitar, and he was in the Mississippi Delta, his vocals could have carried a lot of his art. In a parallel universe, I could see him filling that role. And he wasn't someone who was fond of his own voice, and he would sometimes admonish himself when he was playing a song that he was now going to shut up and play his guitar, because the guitar, obviously, for him was a voice itself. It was like a partnership, really, though. And I think some of the best guitarists like that, it's fortunate when they can sing, too, because it's like Louis Armstrong. If you have that, it's different, because Hendrix was a better guitarist and a better singer. But you can have a long debate about Louis Armstrong. Was he a better trumpet player? Was he a better vocalist? I mean, it's going to be tight for that sort of top spot. So, yeah, if Hendrix couldn't sing the way that he sang, his music wouldn't have had the power that it did.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. To another live performance, the first time, Pink Floyd doing Dark Side of the Moon from January of 1972. And it sounds like this was perhaps a work in progress for the band at that point.
Right. So we're in Portsmouth for this in England. And great paradox at work here, because Dark Side of the Moon has its 50th anniversary this year. And I think it's one of those albums that we instantly call to mind, probably the top two for this sort of memory as a studio conception, like something that happened and was built not on stages and was made in that environment of the recording studio. The other album, I would say, I'm not saying this is correct, but in terms of perception, I would say that the other album is Sgt. Pepper. They're just like the two. Okay, these are the studio wizardry albums. But well before Dark Side of the Moon came out, Pink Floyd was performing this on stage quite a bit. And really doing what sometimes jazz musicians would do. They were workshopping this, workshopping and woodshopping. So they had tried to do the entire album the night before, but parts of it broke down. Obviously, the music is complex in places. It takes a while to work out. Instead, they scuffed it, and they did this long version of Adam Hart Mother, that not the same that one we've talked about before, but that particular song. So they were actually working this out in front of people. Imagine going to a show like that, and you're hearing songs of that nature, time, in their earliest performances. No one seems to know this about Pink Floyd. They just think that they locked themselves away indoors, and they did all of this crazy stuff with technology at the time, and out came Dark Side of the Moon. But you were buying a ticket and going to the stalls and like, oh, here are these guys. I've never heard this song. That's because there was nowhere to hear it prior to that particular evening you were there.
And the version of Time they do in this performance, very different than the one we're accustomed to hearing.
Right. They had things, like I said, to work out. And I mentioned to you that book that I plan to do, where you can take the guitar solo of Time and from the studio version, and you can do a kind of history of recorded Western sound, because a lot of things are part of that journey. And I would say that this early version is part of that journey, too. So much of the song, it sounds like a strange thing to say, so much of the song is built up around the guitar solo, and the guitar solo isn't something that starts the song. Normally, the song is going to unfurl. You have one part, you move to the next part. Songs are sectional, but it's the guitar solo that gives that song so much of its temporal life. Another example that's similar that way is Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. You can't envision that song without the guitar solo. This guitar solo of that song tells the meat of the song's story. And that's also how it goes with Time. But yeah, I just think it would have been crazy hearing this for the first time on an English winter evening 50 plus years ago. And it's just adventurous. People don't do things like this at all anymore. And that's not someone being a curmudgeon. That's just the reality. They don't.
Can you think of any other examples, Colin, of groups, of artists doing that type of thing, taking out essentially an album that they're working on and seeing how it plays with the crowd and then making adjustments?
It happened certainly a lot more in jazz. Mm. You would have these dry runs, but that's the nature of jazz. And Pink Floyd was jazzy, but as individual players, they didn't have jazz chops. But that's where the term woodshopping really comes from. We think of a jazz musician is going somewhere inside like a woodshed and closing the door, and they're going to be doing what they're doing for however long, and then they'll emerge with their sound. A famous version of that without the actual shed is Sonny Rollins playing to nobody, to passerby, beneath the Brooklyn Bridge, honing his sound for a crucial phase of his career. But in rock and roll, you'll find embryonic versions of the Strokes' first album. They're doing songs. We had talked one time about a Green Day show from 1992 that is just awesome, where their Dookie doesn't come out till 94. And on that particular night in 1992, there are like three or four songs that get these first performances. And it's not an album per se, but one example that I really like with The Lost. And The Lost had such a hard time getting their sound that they wanted, that Lee Mavers wanted for their first album. But they're playing what sounds like a cafeteria with people like on the tables. And Mavers says, new song. And this is kind of like all he says. And then they play There She Goes. And it's just, I mean, for those people, like, imagine if they met up later in life. They had the conversation. Oh, you were there that night too? And I'm sure lots of people would lie about it. But I just, to be in on a moment of musical creation and intimacy like that, I love listening to recordings of that nature.
Another interesting moment of inspiration from the world of jazz, in 1964's Spirited Unity from Albert Ayler, who I was not familiar with, but wow, the music was great. And then to read his story, yet another a jazz guy that died young, but had an interesting life in the short time he was around.
One of those guys, right? Like you said, going to die, like Lee Morgan, gets to the end of the 60s, and then things aren't going to go so hot. But Spiritual Unity was his 1964 album that it was one of the first jazz albums I really got into. And even though it was early days for me, I could tell that there wasn't going to be other albums that I heard like this by him or by anybody. I didn't think like, oh, wow, this jazz stuff. I mean, I was like 20 years old. I didn't think need to find a comparable. It's just like one of those things. It's like in publishing. And publishers always talk about comparables. And I feel like if they're comparables to what you do, you suck or you're not that good. Anything that I care about a lot, there's nothing to compare it to. They're like, what are you going to compare A Christmas Carol to? What are you going to compare Citizen Kane to? What are you going to compare A Hard Day's Night to? There really isn't anything. And Spiritual Unity by Albert Eiler and his trio, it fits that same bill. You have this amalgamation of earliest jazz, at least so far as we imagine it, like Buddy Bolden, 1800s type of jazz, and New Orleans funeral marches. And you have a drummer in Sonny Murray who's not playing the beat. He's not keeping the time. This was new at the time. He was doing his own thing, coloring as if he was a guitarist who was augmenting. He just happened to have a trap kit. So no one was playing as free as Eiler was at the time. And he was someone that John Coltrane listened hard to. Coltrane, another skilled listener. He listened hard to Albert Eiler. He listened hard to Eric Dolphy. These were the guys who were really breaking the path in front of everyone else at the time.
And I read a quote from Eiler about the session saying, as you point out, we weren't playing, we were listening to each other.
Oh, right. That's such a huge thing. Not just with jazz, but with life. To listen is, the way he described it is that they weren't even creating sound. They were absorbing and reacting to the sound around them. In other words, what the bandmates had said. It must have felt like something, you understand the title. The title is so bang on apt, that notion of spiritual unity. If you think about how they must have left the studio that day, it wouldn't have been like, oh, good gig, man. It would have seemed like something intimate had passed between these people at the level of who they were. It might have even been hard for them to, in a way, to face each other. I sort of imagine for like a few days when you have that level of intimacy with someone who's not your spouse or your best friend or something like that. I don't know, but it's the type of record that makes you think in those terms. And Eiler's tone was just massive. And I think that's another thing that would have drawn someone like Coltrane. You wanted the big tone, but the big tone had normally been deployed in the service of something like swing, Herschel Evans with the Basie Band, Ben Webster with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. The big tone didn't so readily pair, or so people thought, with free jazz, with the avant-garde. So that was also new.
I love the story about Eiler, who had been requested. Apparently, one of Coltrane's final wishes was to have Eiler and Ornette Coleman play at his funeral, and they claim that during his performance, Eiler ripped his saxophone from his mouth at two points, once to emit a cry of anguish, the other a cry of joy to symbolize his friend and mentor's ascension into heaven.
Eiler was, people talk about being chill. If someone says something like that to me, again, not to be repetitive, but I tend to think that they suck. I like people who go for things, and they go for things in whatever way, whether it's in the quality of their character, whether it's in their art, whether it's combo, whether it's in seeking actual justice in the world, whether it's in trying to help others. And all of that was Eiler, all of that pooled in who he was. So he was someone, and other jazz musicians at the time, when he got this offer, it wasn't for a lot of money. I mean, now, I guess it might seem like a lot of money. But at the time, jazz was still pretty big. And there wasn't a lot of money that he was offered to record this Spiritual Unity album for this upstart indie label, ESP. And he took the money anyway. And the reason he did that small bit of money, rather than holding out, because other jazz musicians thought that affected them negatively because he wasn't, it's like the players' union in baseball or whatever. He was so hell-bent on getting his work out there. That's what he was answering to. He's like, I need this record in my head out in the world, even if I'm getting shafted on the cost right now. And he said, people need to hear this. It's important. And that's not arrogance. That's just how it is. That's, again, it's someone trying to find an answer to their own version of justice. Not that it's relative, but that's what had to happen. And he was in service to that need.
Let's move up from there to the first radio feature that Orson Welles did at the ripe old age of 22 in 1937, a seven-part series, an adaptation of Les Miserables, that kind of set the template for a lot of future radio work Welles would do as he served as both narrator and played the part of Jean Valjean.
It did, but it's a lot longer than what else he's going to do on radio going forward. How's that for a start? Why don't you take this giant French novel, guy who's old enough to still be in college and having a cake party as a big man on campus, and Welles didn't go to college. And you don't need to either, listeners. You can learn all of these things out in the world on your own. But he to condense this novel into this 2.5-hour production, he wasn't doing 2.5-hour productions later to make this work. And something that should be considered with this, too. Like, for instance, John Lennon in 1963 and 64, that's the sweet spot of his singing voice. You can hear him off mic during an outtake saying, ow, ow, just the way that comes out of his mouth. Orson Welles was in his vocal prime in the late 1930s. You have to be careful because he's going to make money later. He's even going to be in, the Transformers, like in the 80s. He's going to make money off of that voice later on, and like for the rest of his life. And it's going to help finance his projects. But that voice becomes deeper and increasingly baronial. He's not baronial here. He is commanding, but he still retains the quality of the cherub. And it's the cherub who knows things, the cherub of sagacity. So we also get it with especially the 1938 production of A Christmas Carol. I think that's really the best he ever was vocally. But as the narrator here and as the main character going through all of these trials and tribulations, no personal overhauls, he is just, what can you say? He's killing it here. He's 22 years old.
It's so good. And I sat down to listen to it, and I thought, well, I'll listen to the first episode last night and see how it goes, and ended up listening to four episodes and then listening to more today because it was just great entertainment. It was so well done. A brilliant supporting cast. Some of the regulars that would be part of the stable, Ray Collins, Everett Sloan, Agnes Moorehead, but also a young Richard Widmark making an appearance.
I know, and that's a strange one. You don't really expect to find him there. But, well, like you said, he keeps it moving along. He knew how to pick them up and put them down and just run the race as fast as you needed to. Not to overtax or anything like that or go too fast, but he understood the need to keep the drama moving. So when you have that moment where the Jean Valjean comes back and he sort of gives himself up, I can understand exactly what you mean because it is long, and you just. But if you listen to the different parts, and you know that he's been identified, and some other man has been falsely accused, you need to know what that guy's going to do. And then I am Jean Valjean. It's like, oh wow, you did it! Like it's intense. It's exciting. There are no explosions. There are no guns. There's anything like that. It's just that moment of saying that he is indeed that man. It's always going to be that kind of thing that thrills us the most. It's not blue beings in Avatar. It's this.
I found myself wondering, you know, how many people in the late 1930s, at a party somewhere and talking about books, and someone said, "Well, have you ever read Les Miserables?" And people saying, "Oh yeah, of course, I know the story completely." But all they had ever heard was the Wells version, which might have been more entertaining than reading the book.
It wouldn't have been a lesser substitute. And so many of the innovation, the hallmarks, not that he was repeating himself, they're in place. It is no easy task to essentially just come out fully formed. It's like coming out of the womb instead of like, there you are, all covered in the mucus and everything. You're like, ta-da, you're ready to go. He was ready to go. And you almost want to make some glib comment, like, 22-year-olds today. You can't do that, because Orson Welles, he wasn't other 22-year-olds, but he also wasn't really a 22-year-old, because so much of who he was who he was, but it was also the environment in which he was in. That's something that we might not have a say in the former issue, but we all have a say with the second concern. You can surround yourself with things, partake of things, listen to things, whatever it may be, and that's going to impact who you are. The same as, like, when you are born in Poland, you're going to eventually, when you talk, you're going to sound Polish and use the Polish language, because environment is huge. So this 22-year-old, he might as well have been 220 years old, because he'd always taken care to surround himself and to inform himself with things of consequence.
Let's wrap up this week by discussing a poem by the great John Keats, What the Thrush Said.
So this is our Mr. Keats in 1818. People are going to be like, so why do I care about that? Call it 1818. It means nothing to me. What it means is it's before he's going to do the poems upon which his reputation, his legacy, and so much of the legacy of poetry and English poetry is based. And this poem comes from a letter to John Hamilton Reynolds, who was a fellow poet, and they would compete with each other, which I like. I enjoy competition. I enjoy a level playing field. And they tried to spur each other on to see who would get better. It's a short poem, so just a few lines, so I'll do it here. O thou whose face hath felt the winter's wind, whose eye hath seen the snow clouds hung in mist, and the black elm tops among the freezing stars, to thee the spring will be a harvest time. O thou whose only book has been the light of supreme darkness, which thou feddest on night after night when Phoebus was away, to thee the spring shall be a triple morn. O fret not after knowledge, I have none, and yet my song comes native with the warmth. O fret not after knowledge, I have none, and yet the evening listens. He who saddens at thought of idleness cannot be idle, and he's awake who thinks himself asleep. What he's talking about in large part, after he sort of shifts from the cadences of this songbird to this more ruminative state, is Socratic knowledge. Socrates was like, oh, I don't really know anything. And he did what Orson Welles did. For all of Welles' erudition and everything that Keats knew, there was an opening up to the world, that humility of saying, I'd like to know more. It drives me personally crazy if I don't know something. I have to find out more about it. Like, it bothers me. And that has really added up to a lot in my life, but it doesn't really happen that much anymore. But when it does, I always make a point. It's just a way of experiencing and being open to the world. And that's what makes sense that Keats is writing this in the context of a letter before he's going to be doing Ode to a Nightingale, for instance.
And was the same age when he wrote it as Wells was when he was doing Les Mis.
Right. And again, it's that notion of how old do you want to be? We see this in our society, and I've written about this a bunch. People who always want to talk about being an old man, I'm so old, blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't even make mathematical sense. Like, for instance, if you're 50 and you're saying you're so old, and even if you don't exercise that much or at all, which is apparently one out of four people, you you can make it into your 80s. Look at some of the people making it into your 80s. So what age are you then at 79 if you're already old at 50? It's really not even a chronological number thing. And the same goes when we're young. You can know someone who is 20 years old who can be much older than their actual birth certificate years. But a lot of that also is up to the individual. And Keats and Wells and some of these star-crossed musicians like an Albert Hyler, they chose to be older and wiser than their years would have suggested.
Colin Fleming with us every week on Downtown. Thank you, Colin. We'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.